This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
I wanted to bring up the latest headlines that we just got from Anthony Fauci. He did just make an address, answer questions from reporters in the White House press room. And I'm just kind of recapping some of the headlines that crossed the Bloomberg on it. He said, we won't eradicate COVID, but take it to very low levels. No indication the COVID vaccine. Oh, sorry. These are older ones. Let me just...
Fauci saying not sure the U.S. needs a national testing mandate for domestic travel. Fauci says, we're looking at travel restrictions as a temporary measure. Still recommends that individuals self-quarantine, of course, if not vaccinated. And importantly, would not wait to get the booster shot. There was a question raised about whether or not people should wait until a booster is potentially developed that would be different than the current shots that are available.
And this is all because the CDC has identified the first case of Omicron COVID-19 variant. That's in the state of California. Dr. Fauci saying the individual is self-quarantined and was vaccinated. Let's just get to it with Bob Langreth. He's our healthcare reporter at Bloomberg News here in our Interactive Brokers studio. What's important here?
Well, I guess this really isn't a big surprise. Everyone was expecting the first case, and this is kind of what you might have expected, a traveler coming back from South Africa. Mild symptoms so far, fully vaccinated. There are maybe some signs of immune evasion with this variant. And the fact is, we just don't know a lot about this variant right now. What we do know is that on paper, the number of mutations it has, it does, look worrisome on paper, but we don't know how it's going to perform kind of in the real world. We'll outcompete Delta in the real world. And how much immune evasion of vaccines does it really have?
We're about to enter year two of this pandemic, Bob, but what's a good expectation for when we would have answers to these questions? We're about to enter year three of this pandemic. Did I say year two?
Crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy.
Yeah, it feels like...
It can't possibly
be that long, but yeah, it is. So we'll get answers to some of these questions, especially in terms of how well it stacks up against existing vaccines fairly quickly. Those kind of tests can be done in the lab with blood of vaccinated people, and that takes, 2 to 3 weeks. So we'll know, we'll get a much better sense, by mid-December. And one thing I would really like to emphasize is that, we're not starting from zero again. We're not going to go back to zero again. People have been vaccinated. There's protection that goes beyond antibodies. So there's a good reason to believe that even if there's a fading of efficacy, it'll still protect against some of the more severe consequences, because we're not just going back to zero. It's over the starting point to year zero of the pandemic. And that's a good thing to keep in mind.
Is this like when the Delta variant came out, though? What's the difference?
Yeah, we don't really know yet whether it's going to take off like the Delta variant. There's other examples, there's the Mu variant, and that was the one that had some immune evasion, and then people were worried about it. And it really only took off in Latin America, which I think was a big thing in Colombia, but it just didn't go anywhere else. So we really have to see, what this does in the real world, how well it transmits in the real world, and the level of immune evasion. And that's just going to take a little time to figure out, producing this period of uncertainty.
Bob, in layperson's terms, what is unique about this variant? What sets it apart from other variants?
What's unique and what's surprising about this variant is a lot of people thought that, hey, you had this Delta variant that's just so contagious that, the next big variant is going to be kind of like Delta plus, something on top of Delta. And then what they saw with this was like a total surprise. It doesn't appear, it has kind of the best hits of mutations from all sorts of other, pre-existing major variants, plus some new things that have mostly been seen in, animal forms of COVID. But it doesn't appear to be the descendant of any of the major variants. So it's kind of like a total surprise. And it also is the thing, that's concerning scientists and making them worrisome is that it does have just so many new mutations kind of all at once and just appear. They weren't expecting it. So that's the thing that's really gotten scientists' attention.
Bob, in your story that's on the Bloomberg, you say, and you cite Anthony Fauci, researchers will have a much better view of the variant in 2 to 4 weeks. What's going to happen in 2 to 4 weeks?
Well, the first thing we expect, in the next, 2 to 3 weeks, we'll get data from neutralizing antibody tests against this variant, with existing vaccines plus boosters and the various monoclonal antibody drugs. We'll start to get that in. That'll give us some idea of the immune evasiveness. And then the other thing we're going to see is kind of out in the real world is how much is it actually starting to spread? we'll get some kind of sense of, like, you know, how cases are accumulating, just some sense of what's a transmissibility, and, you know, two, four, you know, some amount of weeks, because it's just a little hard to predict. People didn't predict right away how Delta was going to take off, because it's just hard to assess how the teamwork of all the mutations, how they work together. Because they can look, this one can look bad in paper, this one can look bad in paper, but it's really about, you know, how the mutations all work together and kind of what they do and how they change things. That's sort of hard to tell until you're going to observe what happens.
Fauci pleading with Americans, the tens of millions who are eligible to get vaccinated and are not vaccinated to get vaccinated. Will this do that just in a few seconds?
Well, I mean, that I hope so. I mean, that'd be a good idea. You know, the more people get vaccinated, the better, and the more that'll reduce the case rate and the severe consequences particularly. But, you know, there's still lots of people out there that aren't vaccinated, and with the virus is contagious, that allows it to continue to spread.
You know, what's interesting too is, I mean, is this like when the flu mutates? I mean, how do you look at it in terms of these ongoing mutations? I mean, do we get to a point where, okay, I'm going to get a flu vaccine, I'm going to get a COVID vaccine, but the rest of my life's going to be okay? Or are you at all a little nervous? I mean, you've been watching this from day one and writing about it.
Yeah, so this, you know, it's very interesting. When it came out, people said, you know, hey, it mutates at a slower rate than the flu. And now we're kind of finding out that it has its kind of own mutation game. It's a little bit different from the flu, but its own kind of ways of mutating. And what we don't know, so, is like, will the rate kind of slow down over time as it kind of settles in and becomes sort of an endemic virus? Or, you know, because we have lots and lots of cases all around the world now. And that's sort of, the more cases are, the more it replicates, the more chances to get to develop favorable mutations. And that's kind of all a virus is about, you know, finding ways to spread and develop favorable mutations that...
What's a favorable mutation, meaning not so bad?
Well, yeah, so two things, right? There's one of the main things, the ones that enables it to, you know, be more infective or transmit better.
Okay.
Or one that, you know, helps if there's vaccines and drugs out there, help in people with, you know, a trained immune system that helps evade, you know, the immune responses. Those are the two things. You know, viruses basically exist to spread, and those are the two ways that'll help it. Now, people talk about the severity. And to a virus, doesn't actually care about the severity. That's just like a side effect. It's just trying to spread, and what the harm it does to us is kind of a side effect. So the mutation shouldn't, you know, a priori affect, you know, severity one way or the other. You know, there shouldn't be a necessary trend, but there, you know, might be by chance. It just might work out that way.
Mm-hmm. What's the most important data point for us to keep an eye on, for our audience to keep an eye on?
I think the first thing we're going to get is, you know, in a week or so, a couple of weeks, to start getting your reports on, you know, how this variant does in the lab tests against, you know, existing vaccines. You know, yeah. These are neutralizing antibody tests, and what is the reduction? So, and the scientists will start to probably to worry if there's like more than a tenfold reduction against, you know, in the neutralizing antibodies against this variant, because right now, especially if you get a booster, the vaccines produce a very large kind of almost a surplus of antibodies, so you kind of have extra protection. And that allows, you know, gives you some breathing room, you know, for things that evade the antibodies a little bit. So there, you know, a tenfold reduction or more, people will start to take it quite seriously.
All right. My producer's going to be mad. Quick question. 15 seconds. I mean, we hear from Moderna CEO, Pfizer CEO. What's the voice we need to listen to?
That's a really good question. You know, nobody has all the answers. You just have to kind of wait and see. Don't panic, because we're not starting from zero. Just wait and see what happens.
It's one of those situations. What we know is that we don't know a lot still.
It's like phrase of the day yesterday, right? Wait and see.
Exactly. Bob Langer, thank you so much. It's a busy day with all this developing news. Healthcare reporter at Bloomberg News, a must read on the Bloomberg Terminal. All right. You are listening to Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So, not sure if you noticed, for the first time in 4 years, venture investors are backing more crypto and blockchain startups in the U.S. than they are in Asia.
I didn't notice until I read this story by Lizette Chapman.
Yeah, she points it out.
She does. Lizette Chapman is technology reporter at Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Lizette, let's talk numbers here, because that's what this is all about. What did you find in your reporting when it came to comparing crypto investments and venture capital investments in the U.S. and in Asia?
Right. Well, first off, there's just been this massive surge, as everyone has seen, over the past year into crypto globally. More in this past year, and we're not even done yet, we're only at November, than in the past decade combined. So
wow.
It's increased over sixfold. So this is a phenomenon sweeping across every single country, every single region, except for a few holdouts, standouts, or some that have just really pulled back and really, really clamped down on the regulations, notably China. As we've talked about before, they forbid crypto mining and banking in the spring, and then that became an all-out ban in September. And so, you know, in our research that we worked to put out along with CB Insights, we found that there's basically been, you know, slow to no deal flow since then. You know, VC investors just said, forget it, we're going to put our money elsewhere. And they're putting it in the United States. We've seen the deals surge here during that time. And for the first time in 4 years, the number of deals here and the amount invested surpassed that of Asia.
And that's a 180, specifically when we think about China, right? That country, as you write, Lizette, has been a crypto capital.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the case until earlier this year. And when, you know, Beijing banned, like I said, you know, Bitcoin, you know, mining and banking in the spring, they just intensified that from there. And so a lot of founders, you know, either shut down their operations or relocated to other hubs, including Hong Kong and Singapore, which are still strong and make up a large amount of the Asia deals, or Lisbon and the Cayman Islands, of course. So that's something that we're going to continue to watch in the year ahead.
Lizette, part of your story is about crypto going mainstream. And you spoke with Amy Wu at Lightspeed, who said basically that it's going to be the internet of our generation, which, if you've been paying attention to blockchain and to the underlying technology, people have been saying that for years. But is there sort of sea change that you're seeing when it comes to talking to venture capitalists about this?
100%. If they don't have someone devoted to crypto now, they're working hard to get it, and they're getting their mainstream kind of traditional investors and enterprise software and you know, social media companies and the like to become fluent in crypto. They see it as a massive change, not only with where they see the really smart thinkers of our generations collecting, but also the funding. And so you see a lot of mainstream firms raising dedicated crypto funds. That's just, they're sitting on billions of dollars of dry powder right now that they're definitely going to be deploying in the months and years ahead. So we're just going to see this continue to accelerate.
So Lizette, it's not a case of investors and venture capitalists, you know, chasing the shiny new thing. There's a legitimization that's definitely going on. We're seeing it, for better or for worse, regulators getting involved, but that shows that they see this as something that's going to be a part of our financial system in some way.
Yeah, you got that right. There has been kind of like a whiff of fraud or like sketchiness, I guess, because of some of the fraudulent activity that's happened, you know, in a lot of different, crypto, companies and ICOs and things like that. But it doesn't mean that the underlying technology, and I think that, you know, for some time, some people dismiss the underlying blockchain technology that allows decentralized power in a unified way for people to bring their information, and port it from one site to the next. Rather than Google or Facebook owning your information, you would have it in one spot. You wouldn't have 50 logins. You'd have it one on your blockchain, and then you would log in at your leisure. And so we're talking about a different way of reworking the internet so that it's decentralized and it's not through some of the main gatekeepers.
I'm shaking my head here because I'm still faxing. We were promised this years ago, and I'm still faxing medical records from one doctor to another. And I'm like, where can I find a fax machine? So it hasn't happened yet.
There are a lot of companies hard at work on it. I think that there's a bunch of questions right now about, you know, what companies are, not just what they're building in terms of NFTs or non-fungible tokens, like, you know, Bored Ape Yacht Club or what they're doing to purchase, to crowdsource the purchase of our Constitution, but really talking about the underlying infrastructure and thinking about a different way to organize our internet. And you've got, Facebook renaming itself as Meta, and, right, to kind of reflect that. And you've got this happening across the board. I mean, you know, Jack Dorsey, you know, his resignation from Twitter. You know, I think that we're going to be seeing a lot happening in the months ahead.
We got to run. Hey, Lizette, great read. Lizette Chapman, she's tech reporter here at Bloomberg News.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm not going to sing it, but it is the most wonderful time of the year. It's also the Bloomberg Big Take. We're talking about the Bloomberg 50. It is out, Tim.
It's out. What do Britney Spears, Mackenzie Scott, Toni Petersson, and Lena Khan, Joel Weber, all have in common? Joel Weber is editor at Bloomberg Business Week, and also joining us is Brett Biegun, features editor at Bloomberg Business Week.
I think that was four. So there are four of the 50 people and ideas that we are featuring in this year's Bloomberg 50, which is a look back at the year, crazy year that it was, crazy that we're having a year conversation already. But the people who had demonstrable impact in business and finance and entertainment and politics. And this is, you know, a unique list for Bloomberg because, unlike, you know, maybe some other lists of important people, these are people who had an impact this year. We hone that with data, which we'll walk you through with some of these folks. And also, we're not going to have repeats, so you don't end up with Warren Buffett, because you could talk about Warren Buffett on any given year. We want to talk about people who are oftentimes in the zeitgeist, and there's a sense of discovery often that accompanies some of these people, and I think we'll talk a little bit about that too.
So Brett, come on in on it, because from what I understand,
this is all Brett. Yeah, Brett Biegun, who editor at Business Week, and he spends a good chunk of the year wrangling this list, and just a Herculean effort. And thank you, Brett.
Well, how many people do you have to end up ultimately kind of going through and figuring out and whittling it down to 50?
Well, everyone.
Yeah.
Brett,
well,
right?
Thank you, Joel. Yeah, everyone, basically. I think we start with the rough list of maybe 150 to 200-ish people and or ideas. As Joel pointed out, we do love to have an inanimate object on the list every year. We did the Popeye's fried chicken sandwich 2 years ago.
That was a favorite.
We had the special purpose acquisition company last year, and this year, the meme stock is our inanimate object, and Matt Levine wrote about that for us. So yeah, I'd say we start about maybe 150 to 200.
And out of you know, billions, right? But let's talk about the sort of the metric component of this, Brett, because I think that's one of the things that really distinguishes it. How do we assess that? And by we, I mean you. How do you assess how a metric stacks up so that there's actually a sense of data underlying the names?
Yeah, I mean, you have to have something quantifiable in 2021 to make it onto the list. And it also has to be something that's big and that people care about. There are a lot of ways to measure, I think, small successes. But, you know, we're looking for big IPOs. We're looking for big acquisitions. We're looking for a lot of market cap coming in. Like, for instance, with meme stocks, we talk about $150 billion of market cap created at the beginning of this year. It could also be something like, if you're Olivia Rodrigo, who is also on the list, pop star, it could be, you know, having a record-setting year on Spotify with your song Driver's License. So there's got to be a metric. It's got to be something that people care about, and it's got to be something that you kind of look at and either say, wow, I sort of knew about that thing, but I didn't realize it was that big, or I had no idea about that thing, and now I'm learning about it.
To that end, I also mentioned this earlier, that sense of discovery. And here's a name that achieved that for me. Who is Paige Beckers?
Yeah, Paige Beckers is one of my favorite people on this list. And Paige's metric is that she signed two of the more high-profile name, image, and likeness deals. And these are the deals that college athletes are now free to sign in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling, basically paving the way for them to make money for the first time. Paige is a sophomore shooting guard at the University of Connecticut, has a long line of very famous stars that go into the WNBA, Diana Taurasi, Brianna Stewart. But she's lucky in that she came along at a time where now she can be a star there and earn a lot of money. And the average college athlete right now with NIL endorsement is earning something sort of shy of $700 total.
Wow,
but a lot of people think that Page, a lot of people think that Page is poised to really be among the biggest winners. And she signed two deals so far, one with Gatorade, which we all know, and she's the first college athlete ever signed by Gatorade. And the second is really interesting. The second deal is with StockX, which we've written about, but it's an online marketplace for streetwear. And the cool thing about this deal is that it's going to allow her to do a lot of sort of branded collaborations really with whoever she wants, like brands like, say, Supreme or something like that. And she can take that data that she accumulates through these sales, and when she gets to the WNBA in 3 years and a shoe company, let's say, tries to ask for a discount, because unfortunately a lot of female athletes are asked for discounts on merchandise, she's going to say, you know what, actually, you can pay me what you pay the guys, because here's my track record selling. So it's a very interesting deal. It's really unique. And yeah, she's awesome.
Hey, Brett, one name that really stuck out to me on the list was Eugene Goodman. And I think back to January 6th. And this indeed was written by Billy House. And I was in this studio with Carol on that day. And Billy was on the phone with us, giving us a play-by-play about what was happening at the Capitol. Tell us about Eugene Goodman.
Yeah, Eugene Goodman is the Capitol police officer who fended off insurrectionists for about 85 seconds and likely saved some lives, or certainly injury in doing so. He himself has not spoken at length about his experiences on that day. He's chosen not to. But we honored him, and we had Billy write about it. This is the first time that Billy has reflected on his experience on that day, on January 6th, and what it was like to be on lockdown. And given Billy's expertise, he sort of walks us through what it was like to both be on lockdown, but really what life was like there in normal times. So you get a better sense of exactly what was sort of transpiring and how different it was from how Billy's day might normally have been. It's a very, very powerful piece that he wrote.
Brett, we're running out of time. Got 30 seconds. I mean, you've got Goldman's 13 anonymous junior investment bankers. We've got Matt Stone and Trey Parker. Is there one thing that you got, like a million people saying, yeah, you got to have this? I'm thinking it might be meme stock, but I'm just curious, and just got about 20, 25 seconds.
Oh, God, that's a Carol, you're putting me on the spot here. But, there are so many people that we sort of feel compelled to do it. One of the ones I love is, I'm glad we got David Zaslav on.
Yeah.
I'm glad we got Jason Sudeikis on the list this year.
I believe that's Ted Lasso.
Who doesn't love Ted Lasso, right? And they won seven Emmys in September.
It's a list that's just so much fun to go through, and I'm so glad we got some time with you. Really well done again. Brett Biegun, he is features editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Jill Weber, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. Check it out. It's online and it's in the magazine. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, back in January of 2020, our next guest found himself on a speedboat in the Saigon River in southern Vietnam. He was there to learn all about the supply chains of Asia. Well, we all know what happened next. Lockdowns around the world and then empty shelves. Supply chains as we know it rocked and changed. Christopher Mibbs is technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal, also the author of Arriving Today, From Factory to Front Door, Why Everything Has Changed About How and What We Buy. Chris joins us on Zoom from Baltimore. Chris, why did you initially write this book before the everyday American was thinking about supply chains?
And I want your crystal ball. I'm just going to say that.
Yeah, it really came from witnessing the transformation in terms of automation and other types of technology that was happening in supply chains because of Amazon. And I just thought, okay, if e-commerce is going to become the dominant way that we buy things, this is going to be huge for millions of American workers and for every single one of us, because we're all consumers. So I wanted to understand how those supply chains worked, because it was clear that they were undergoing a transformation unprecedented since the invention of the shipping container.
Safe to say that we all just expect stuff to show up at our door. We don't really think about the process. We've gotten so removed from it. For many of us, there are a lot of workers that are the backbone of our supply chains, but for many of us, we're removed from it, right?
Yeah, we're so removed from it, and we're even more removed from it than we used to be because of globalization. The supply chains are longer than ever. So when they get disrupted, we kind of throw up our hands and we're like, what's going on?
take us back to that time in January of 2020 when you were exploring supply chains in Asia. What did you end up finding out, especially as the pandemic began to ravage the globe?
Well, what I witnessed was really the supply chain disruptions and the congestion that we're seeing now. So, you know, I was standing on the quayside in Vietnam when goods are being loaded, just as the World Health Organization announced that there was, you know, an issue in Wuhan, China. And then, it was inadvertent on my part that the book coincided with the pandemic. But, you know, as I sort of followed the journey of those goods all the way to the U.S., I ended up, you know, in places like, FedEx sortation facility, talking to the head of automation at FedEx about how what used to be the holiday peak was now every single day, and that they were anticipating that when the holidays did arrive, they would have what they called peak on top of peak. So you had this system that was really sized for, you know, maybe a holiday peak that was then having to do that holiday peak just as part of its normal line of business. You know, I also rode along with a UPS driver, you know, who told me that, you know, she was really keeping everybody on her route supplied with, you know, everything from the goods to homeschool their kids to, you know, food and other things that they were ordering that were being delivered through UPS. And that every day she was as busy as she would normally be during the holidays. But of course this was, you know, nowhere near the holidays. So the entire system now has had to expand to accommodate what used to be its maximum capacity.
Hey, Chris, I too have ridden along with a UPS driver. Talk about being impressive. And they have technology and data to make sure that, you know, they are aware of everything they do, how long it takes, and keeping track of it. It blew my mind. Having said that, so when you look at all the work that you did and really understanding the nitty-gritty details, the technology, the logistics, the people behind our global supply chain, do you clearly understand the mess that we're in today?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, fundamentally, this gets to the heart of, you know, the most important macroeconomic indicators, which drive everything, you know, the entire stock market. Like, the reason that we're having inflation that the Fed cannot deal with right now is we're having a supply shock. The reason we're having a supply shock is that we're having congestion in the supply chain. And part of that congestion is due to the labor crisis. We don't have enough people to drive the trucks to move all the containers out of all these ports. So, you know, Maersk's chairman just said the end of last week they had more than 80 ships waiting on average 18 days at ports all over the world, but in particular on the West Coast. So the shocks and the bottlenecks at every one of these junctures in the supply chain, I think, are key to understand, because these seemingly small things are what are driving ultimately, you know, inflation. And I think a lot of investors' fears that this new coronavirus will, you know, hurt the economy and hurt the stock market.
Chris, do you think that the era of just in time, when it comes to the way that companies think about getting us our goods, the era of globalization, do we see any permanent shifts or changes to those things as a result of the pandemic and what we've learned?
I think you're seeing a lot of smaller manufacturers and retailers are having to stockpile more goods. So in that way, you know, this era of lean everything is over for a lot of retailers. And, you know, the biggest ones that are reporting that the supply chain is starting to clear for them, like Target and Walmart, they're the ones who order well in advance. So in some ways, I think, you know, just in time, you know, is disappearing. That said, you know, as soon as this supply chain backlog clears, it could be as early as next summer. You know, I think people will return to that because, of course, it just drives more returns on everything, returns on capital. Nobody wants to have a bunch of goods
right
tied up in inventory if they can avoid it.
Right. But you think about those balance sheets and how they would change. You know, it's funny. I grew up with, I guess you would say, kind of Depression era parents, or parents who grew up with families that, you know, had to deal with the Depression. And we always had a utility room that was stock full of so much stuff. But I think they remember, you know, when things were lean, you know, there were lean times and you couldn't get stuff. And I do wonder the impact that this will have on all of us going forward, or perhaps our families going forward, and maybe companies, as you just talked about, you know, going forward.
Yeah, I mean, how many of this have returned to that in some respect? I'll bet everybody listening to this has on average, you know, 500% more toilet paper in their closet than they
guilty
did before the
as
pandemic.
Charged.
So absolutely, I think people are at every node of the supply chain, which, by the way, includes us, includes our individual households. You know, people are being forced to stockpile more goods. And yeah, those Depression era mentalities, they don't go away. I mean, I don't know about you guys, you know, but I have a household full of kids And having lived through this, I mean, maybe they'll be like the, you know, those depression era silent generation people where they grew up to stockpile a lot more goods because they remember, you know, the pandemic of 2021 and 2020.
Right. And let's not forget the supply chain. We talk about it as logistics and technology, but there are so many people involved in it. And Chris really gets into that in his book. It is such a timely book, really brilliant. I hope you'll come back again because this is certainly going to be an issue we'll be covering for some time. Be well. Christopher Mims, he's technology columnist at Wall Street Journal. His book, it's out, arriving today, From Factory to Front Door, Why Everything Has Changed About How and What We Buy. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and we are Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no. This is not a toy.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, what a day. Lots going on. Obviously, we listened to Jay Powell in his testimony earlier, second day of testimony up on Capitol Hill. What really, though, seems to be weighing on the equity trade is the concerns about the Omicron COVID variant and getting the first case here in the United States. We do have equity averages just bouncing off their lows of the session, but just barely. So let's get to it. Let's get to the Drive to the Close. Dan Pipitone is co-founder of Trade Zero America. He's back with us on the phone in Brooklyn. Where do you even begin? Where do we begin?
Dan, well, Brooklyn is the borough, so we can start there.
So let's start there. This trade today, is it all about the Omicron variant?
It's looking that way. You know, what started off as one of the biggest gainer days in quite some time. Super reversal with the announcement of some cases found in California. You know, to be honest, I would have thought that, you know, this, some of the stuff would have been priced in already. I don't think anyone had any illusions, that it wasn't coming here. I think everyone eyes wide open that it was going to happen. And I would have thought that, you know, some of this would have been priced in,
okay,
but,
thank you.
Being totally wrong.
Thank you. That's what I don't understand it. We, you know, there are even argument in the past few days that, gosh, it says, you know, that the United States doesn't sequence the same way that other countries, including South Africa, do, and the UK especially. So we don't have the same type of widespread availability of understanding who has what variant. So it, everyone knew this was coming, Dan. So why do you still think we saw the sell-off?
News, you know, people are going to, you know, sell on news, and the news hit, and there it is. Yeah. But, you know, I think we are seeing things bounce a bit coming into the close here. But, yeah, I like I said, I would have thought this would have been priced in. This move is a total surprise to me.
Interesting. So what happens here? I mean, I guess what we have to do is watch maybe some technical levels, or what are you watching here? And I'm curious, what are you seeing on the part of the retail investor who often, when they see a pullback, kind of like a Cathie Wood, find that as an opportunity?
Yeah. So, I mean, today's been pretty fun from a trading perspective. You know, the volatility creates opportunity, and, you know, that's what our traders love, really thriving on intraday volatility. As you guys know, we really accentuate our offering on the short side. We are facilitators of short sells and do so in a very robust way. So on days like today, having the wherewithal and the bandwidth and the capacity and access to trade bi-directionally is pretty powerful.
What are you seeing in terms of what people are actually buying, what people are selling, and what their activity is today? And how is that different from a typical day?
Sure. Today, we've seen a lot of activity in ABUS, Airbus. Arbutus Pharma.
Yeah, that was Dave Stock. That was Dave Stock of the day.
Yeah.
There was some news out in this today. So this is a nice early morning gapper. Went to a high of $6.50. Right now trading at $4.50. So stocks like this, you know, we've traded a couple million shares on this today. And this is, you know, the stocks like this and market days like this are really what, you know, what the trader lives for.
Well, they're looking for some, what we have seen is more volatility, certainly in the trade. And that's what, you know, investors are looking for, right? Some movement where they can actually play the market a little bit.
We've seen, you know, lately, last couple of weeks, you know, a lot of movement in the EV sector, you know, lots of movement, Tesla leading the charge, but, you know, Lucid, Lee Auto, Arrival has been a stock that's been in play lately, along with Fisker Automotive. The EV sector has been really attractive from the trader's perspective over the last month or so.
Tell me, you know, one thing that we talked about, and again, going back to our colleague Dave Wilson, who's retiring today, he talked about the democratization of trading, and that's certainly something that you guys do at Trade Zero, allowing access for people to actually make trades that you couldn't do at the same way a generation ago. And I'm wondering to what extent you think this sticks around post-pandemic, the rise of the retail trader, because there was this narrative that, you know, people would go back to work and we wouldn't see the Wall Street Bets crowd and the meme stocks. Correct. Has activity cooled off at all for you?
Well, I think measuring from the height of the pandemic on a sort of a per person perspective, things have definitely cooled off a bit. However, you know, retail today making about 25% of the market volumes, up from about 10%, you know, just in 2010. This phenomenon is not only happening here in the U.S., it's happening globally. And sort of the new dynamic is not really when retail is going to peter out, but really for institutions to get a better handle on what is next in focus for retail. As we've seen with Tesla, with crypto, there are many instances lately where retail has been the leader with the meme stocks, where now you have, you know, dynamics where institutions are looking at things like investor sentiment and social media sentiment to really try and understand democratization of finance, the democratization of the dissemination of information, what's next for the retail investor. And so it's been interesting to see where, you know, the dynamic of retail being the last to know has really been turned on its side, where institutions are now looking to retail for what they should be looking at next.
So as you look out at, you know, I can't believe it's December. We're getting ready to wrap up the year. We're going to get, you know, a new year. When you think about, and I know you are tracking like what's going on your platform and the trades, and that's why we love talking to you. But when you think of some of those big macro stories that we always have to talk about, and I think specifically about the Federal Reserve monetary policy, Jay Powell up there on Capitol Hill, many would argue he was a lot more hawkish. Our Taylor Riggs over on the TV side saying it was a new Jay Powell, you know, talking about getting rid of the word transitory, also thinking about, you know, stepping up at a faster pace, those, you know, asset purchases, you know, getting rid of them at a faster pace. Is it interesting that here we have market jitters and volatility increased in a big way, and we had Jay Powell coming out, that he didn't try to maybe taper that down a little bit today?
Right. That is that the timing of all of this is interesting. However, what we've seen in the recent past, you know, when the rubber starts hitting the road, and comments like that actually start to take hold and they actually start doing it, and then there is economic, you know, fallout from that, that's when, you know, the pivot starts happening. And that's when, you know, the messaging starts to change. So it's semi-refreshing that, you know, that there is an end in sight to this up until, you know, the general investing public starts feeling some pain. Those are the instances I feel like in the last 5 years where, you know, the Fed and the government has stepped in a way that's been unnatural, you know, prior to this, you know, these last couple of years. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, when people start really feeling when there's some news or people start experiencing, you know, some fallout from these decisions, if the decisions remain.
What kind of fallout, for example?
High unemployment, wages falling, you know, things like that.
Yeah, well, that stuff's not happening. I mean, look at the Beige Book and what we got today. Wages are going up in substantially in parts of the country.
Right. But a lot of people are still at home. A lot of people haven't come back to work. A lot of people have left the labor force. So, you know, now if a tightening does start happening, it'll be interesting to see kind of how it shakes out. And if tightening is what's needed, if that remains in place, to the detriment potentially of the American worker.
And let's not remember that, or let's not forget that when the Fed and Jay Powell say things, it's perhaps May, like there are always caveats. Dan, we got to run. Dan Pipitone, co-founder of Trade Zero America, on the phone from Brooklyn.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.